Hi, I'm Libby.
And I'm Riley, and welcome to On the Come Up. Hey, besties.
Hey, besties.
How's everyone doing? We missed you.
We're so excited to be back with another incredible guest.
Yay.
Today, we're talking about some pretty heavy stuff, but pretty important stuff as well that I think everybody, especially in our generation, should be aware of. And we have Emily Hoffman here on the podcast with us. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. This is so exciting.
Emily, one thing that I love that Emily self-describes sometimes is being a quiet activist, which I think is a really important term that we're going to get to. But Emily is a lawyer, and she also is really, really into animal rights and actually works for an organization that deals with animal rights. And she's kind of that face behind the scenes who is working to make everything happen. So we're excited to dive into your history, Emily.
Yes. Get us started with a little bit of your background, kind of like high school and before.
Sure. So let's see, where do I start? I don't want to say, so I was born in March of 1997, but I think something about me that leads into the topic today is that I've always been someone that is extremely values-driven, and once I decide something, I really go all the way with it.
Love that.
As a kid, I was really justice-oriented. When I saw injustice in the world, I know starting when I was 6, 7, 8, I can think of specific examples where I would see something and I would think, and I would have so many conversations with my mom about, this isn't right. Why do people think this? And then I would make it kind of a mission or a crusade to make sure that everyone around me knew, this thing is happening. This is bad. This is wrong. This is scary. People are hurt. What can we do? So I got a reputation in middle school where people wouldn't say certain things around me because they knew it would start something.
I was about to say, at this point, she's only like 11.
Like, yes. Oh, no. The first time was probably around 7. So
is all happening in Toledo, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I was born in Toledo. I still live in Toledo. Born and raised.
Love that. We love a 419 gal.
Yes, I went to Sylvania schools, where my mom is on the school board now. My sister teaches there. So this is a community that I've been in and been a part of.
Shout out to previous forever. Guest, Katie Hoffman.
Yes, shout out to your first guest, my sister.
Truth.
Who is a wonderful teacher and also integral to who I am as a person, has taught me a lot. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I love my sister so much.
But so obviously this is something that's always been a part of who you are, is your value system. And that's mm-hmm. something that you've not only carried with you throughout your whole life, but also into every aspect, like the organizations you're involved with, your career. So talk to me, back it up just a little bit before we get to lawyer, Emily. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your college education. So you started at Miami, but then you moved to a different college. So talk a little bit about your undergrad experience.
Sure. So I went into college thinking that I was going to be a musical theater actress because musical theater is one of my passions, but it's not necessarily in line with my lifelong pursuit of my values. So I initially went in with a double major of political science and musical theater, and on day one, I realized this isn't for me. And while at Miami, before I even started classes, I switched to do musical theater and biology. While I was there, I only went to Miami for one semester. The culture wasn't right for me. I struggled a lot with my mental health while I was there, and it was really difficult for me to be away from home. So I finished out that first semester with the biology major. And knowing with my one theater class that was not going to be the path for me, I decided vet school was going to be the next move, and came home to regroup. And I decided that BG was going to be the right fit for me. It was close enough to home where I could commute, and I liked the program that they had there in terms of biology, and I was – excited to head there with my major in biology, and then I started with a minor in chemistry.
Oh, so wow.
I love science.
Yes.
And you'll be able to tell that from this conversation, that science and biology is still really at the forefront of the things that I think about constantly. But I was at Miami, was at BG, taking biology classes, and at that time I started thinking more about ethics, and I've been a vegetarian since I was 2.5.
Oh, I love that.
But
I'm also a vegetarian.
Oh, I love to hear that. And I was taking classes. I took a class about sustainability, and it got me thinking about where I wanted to go with my life. And this was in 2016, so I felt a shift inside of myself at that time, where I realized that being a vet wasn't going to be fulfilling in the way that I think I needed a career to be fulfilling. Mm-hmm. I needed something that I felt was making the world a better place. I needed something in line with the things that I was thinking about every single day, mainly the environment, which, if you know me, you know that I panic if I think about the existence of landfills for too long. So
true facts.
Yes,
that's
yeah.
very real.
And I switched my minor to political science, and I said, I think law school is going to be right for me. I want to make the world safer, and I want to advocate for those who don't have advocates, who have been silenced, who aren't represented. So I figured being a lawyer is going to be my right next move. So
no, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about that process of getting into law school and, you know, what that looked like for you at that time.
Well, I cast a weird net, actually, because I intended to move to New York City for some unknown reason, maybe tied to my love of musical theater. But so I applied to a lot of schools there, and I applied also to a couple of schools in Ohio just to see if I wanted to stay closer to home. And I happened to hear back from Case Western in Cleveland, where I had never been other than to baseball games with Riley's family. And I was accepted as a part of their international law program, which okay. I didn't have a strong interest in international law. They kind of put me on that path. Mm-hmm. They selected me for that, and the scholarship opportunity was too incredible to pass up. So I
very fair.
I figured I didn't thrive the first time going away from home, and I was only 4 hours that time. Maybe let's not hop straight to New York City. So, and with that scholarship, I visited Case Western, and I had a really wonderful interview, and it has a great reputation. I really liked Cleveland, so yeah. I figured
that's awesome.
It kind of fell into my lap, and I'm really glad that it did. I met some wonderful people there, and the coursework was good. I loved my professors.
Yeah. So tell us, kind of, you're on the path of international law. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of choose your focus?
Yeah, so that didn't last all that long because it was kind of handed to me. It wasn't necessarily the path I would have chosen for myself. And I knew very quickly that public interest would be the area for me. And I think there's a divide in law school. People go in and they're either on the corporate law track or they're on the public interest track. So they're going to be something like a public defender, or they're going to work for a big firm making hundreds of thousands of dollars right out of law school. Mm-hmm. You know, if you choose the public interest track, it's not necessarily a lucrative direction.
Fair.
But it, you know that the work that you're doing means something to someone, and you're advocating in the spaces where people need advocates.
Well, and even for yourself, I mean, it aligns with your own moral compass, which is very important. I don't think you would be able to be in that other type of job knowing that you were not serving different communities that you wanted to help.
Right. And it didn't even cross my mind to do corporate law. So I focused initially, when you start law school, your whole first year, everyone's taking the same classes.
Right.
So you all take contracts, you all take torts, you all take legal writing, and then after that, your second year, you start to split off into, you get to take electives. So I took environmental law, which I wasn't sure was for me either because it's a lot of bureaucracy. It's not, and a lot of environmental law is just figuring out for corporations how to get around environmental law, and unless you're working for something like a nonprofit. And so my second year, I did, in law school, you also do, between years, you'll do an externship or work with some sort of entity that's in line with what you're looking for. So my first year, between 1L and 2L years, they call law school years L, so 1L, 2L, 3L.
Cute.
And so between my first and second year, I worked at the 6th District Court of Appeals here in Toledo. Mm-hmm. And that was just a lot of legal research and writing, which I love legal research and writing. I became a teaching assistant for legal research and writing my second year. But then between 2L and 3L year, I worked at Legal Aid here in Toledo. Mm-hmm. And I worked with victims of domestic violence. And I found that fulfilling, but it didn't feel like it went all the way for me, like, down into my heart. It meant something, and it's work that I think is valuable, but it didn't necessarily feel like something that would be sustainable for me forever.
Right.
It's a lot of trauma. It's a very specific group of people, and I don't know if I have the manner, I want to say bedside manner, to care for victims, to look people in the eye. I don't know that I'm a very comforting person, and I think that there's a space and there are certain groups of people who need advocates, who need additional support, that I don't know that I'm the best person to provide. So I don't think that was a space for me.
And I love that, though, like, you're recognizing.
I know myself, and I know that people deserve more care than I think I would be able to provide long term. And my mom is a family lawyer, and I've watched her over and over again provide that kind of care and support to clients. And that's just not me.
Right.
So that third year, I worked in the clinic the entire year with I was in the second chance reentry clinic for those who had been formerly incarcerated and who were dealing with obstacles in their life. So in terms of family law, in terms of housing, so helping people getting their records expunged or helping them to access services.
Right.
And I found that fulfilling too, but in the same way where I didn't find legal aid to be the right space for me, it didn't feel like somewhere I was meant to be forever.
Right. I mean, and I think ultimately at the end of the day, your biology studies in undergrad plus your love of law, I think, combines perfectly for you to work in animal rights law. And so talk a little bit about, you know, animal rights and preservation of our planet's nature have always kind of been at the forefront of your life. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about your path to ending up fighting for our planet and for animals that live on our planet with your, you know, current path.
Right. So I've always loved animals since the moment I can recall having a consciousness. Animals have always been really important to me. I rode horses growing up. And if you know anything about horses, there's something about them where they have this energy where they're with you. They respond to you. They have a sensitivity where they just have this wisdom and understanding. And if it's really difficult to explain unless you've spent time with horses, but that was something that I spent a lot of my childhood years and a lot of developmental time with horses and on a farm. And that meant a lot to me. My relationships with the animals that I met there meant a lot to me, and they still do. And while I was looking for my path in law school, I was studying for the bar exam and looking for something. So I was scouring the internet, trying to find a fellowship, trying to find something that scratched the itch of what kind of career is going to fill me up,
right,
where I know that I'm doing something that is good for the world, but also good for me, and that could provide me some longevity.
Definitely.
And I ran across a fellowship at an animal organization, and I had a sudden realization that this was an option for me. It wasn't presented in law schools. There weren't classes. There was an animal law class at Case Western, but it didn't run my third year when I would have been able to take it because there wasn't enough interest. So it's not something that I was exposed to heavily, exposed to at all, actually. So when I came across this posting, the thrill, I was so excited. I was telling people, like, this is it. I think this is it. The description alone felt like me.
That's awesome.
And coincidentally, I never heard back from this place, but that led me to keep looking for things in the exact same vein.
Yeah.
Which is how I came across the organization I work for now. I got a fellowship with them for the fall after I graduated law school while I was waiting for my bar results.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on a project where myself and one other attorney, she's now an attorney, and she also now works for us. She came to work for us after she took the bar. And we were doing a project where we were compiling the state laws across the United States and the federal laws. But there are very few of these, shockingly, that protect farmed animal welfare. It was a combination between my love of research and the advocacy for animals, knowing that this guidance would go out to other organizations and advocates looking for spaces where they could move things forward for animals.
Yeah.
I feel like I've lost track of the question now because I'm just remembering looking at all these laws. I love a spreadsheet and I love, and you learn mostly in law school how to read and critically think. So it was reading those statutes and seeing where there were loopholes, seeing where the language was flexible, seeing the influence of industry on what these laws look like. And
it all clicked into place for you.
Yes, clicked is the right word. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and I think a big part of that too is for pretty much your whole life, you've been vegan as a result of your feelings for animals and animal byproducts. And we started talking about that a little bit earlier, but I do want to talk about you making that decision and then what you feel that you've gained from this and, you know, kind of how you feel like you're carrying that moral principle with you into the rest of your career.
I think at first it wasn't even necessarily a decision. When I was 2.5, I randomly stopped eating meat altogether. Mm-hmm. My mom will tell you that I could eat a whole steak when I was 1.5 years. But all of a sudden when I was 2.5 years old, I just refused it across the board. No other foods were off limits, just meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot tell you why this happened, but it was consistent. My mom was told by lots of people that it's just a phase and she'll grow out of it. But it became a part of my identity. At that time, I don't think I knew that meat was an animal, or I, of course, didn't know about factory farming. But there was something inside of me that said, this isn't right. This isn't for me. And during my childhood, as I learned more about animals and animal welfare, I, at one point, was considering, when I was learning about world religions, I learned about Jainism, and Jains are, they are vegetarian as a part of their value system. They actually don't even eat root vegetables because they won't dig into the ground or the soil because they don't want to damage the microorganisms or any living things that are in the soil.
Jainism is fascinating.
They carry brooms with them to sweep the path in front of them so they're not stepping on any living things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the world religion that I felt I identified with the most when I learned about this was in second grade, I think. So nonviolence has always been very important to me. And when I learned about factory farming and when I started to, I became officially, I transitioned from vegetarian, which I was from obviously 2.5 on. It was not a phase, Mom. In high school, I realized, and I'd never liked eggs. Mm-hmm. So I was really only eating like cheese and yogurt. And I thought, why, if I believe that it's wrong to eat animals, why would I participate in a system through like dairy products?
Yeah.
That contributes to the same system I'm not trying to participate in this other area. Mm-hmm. So I made the connection and really strengthened the connection in college. And then it's only gotten stronger as I've read more books and talked to more people and
right.
met other vegans. But
yeah, that's awesome. Do you think that it's ever difficult to, you know, approach some of those conversations and, you know, kind of deal with the misconceptions about veganism and kind of, you know, let people know how you feel about it without being shameful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that I'm not sure I've found the answer to myself. I am the only vegan in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I found approaching these conversations difficult. And I think I personally, when it comes to misconceptions, my original conception of veganism was that it was about what you're eating. Mm-hmm. And for me, veganism as an ethical stance isn't about the food on your plate. It's about your approach to the world and the way that people describe being vegan that I associate with most is it's a practice of doing the least harm in the most ways you can when it comes to animals and the world around us. So it's as far as is practicable. So that's not everyone doing it the exact same way or everyone believing the exact same things. It's a do no harm situation.
Sure.
And I think when you're having these conversations with people, especially when it's a heavy topic, like yeah. you said at the beginning, where – and it's something that you do every day. You eat every day. Mm-hmm. You use products on your skin every day.
Right.
You – so it's not something we're removed from. And – I think something that I've run into is when you tell someone that you're vegan or you tell someone, I think it's wrong to eat animals. I think that using animal products in the things that we use on our bodies, in our clothes, people tend to have big reactions. And I haven't learned, I think, perfectly how to navigate them. But I think it comes from a place of people feel judged, people feel shamed, and I think that that often comes from a place of there is a cognitive dissonance because everyone I've talked to who, if you're really talking about it, you're not going to meet people who say, I don't care about animals, I don't like animals.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you say to them, you know that what you're doing, you look on your plate, you have a burger, you know where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
And the systems that exist now separate people from the animals on their plate or
right.
in their products. We, if you think about it, we call it steak or a burger or beef. You don't say, oh, yeah, I'm having cow today.
Right.
I'm eating pig today. You say I'm having a pork chop.
Yeah.
Chicken is weirdly the exception.
Or like shrimp.
Like, right. And aquatic animals
yeah,
are a
whole
different
story. Yeah, I was
going to
say aquatic animals
thing.
Are a whole different story. But yeah, you're right. Well, I think it's interesting because I've known you pretty much my whole life. And I still eat meat, but I've mm-hmm. never felt any judgment from you about that. Just like I hope you've never felt any judgment from me about the fact that you're vegan. And it's like, to me, I almost feel like people get really shy in those conversations because of the holier-than-thou attitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like if you go out to drinks with a friend and one of the friends is not drinking, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, am I going to be the only one to order a drink? Like, I feel weird. Like, should I do this? Is it bad? Da, da, da. And I think instead of that, you, if you're having that, those shameful feelings or feeling judged, maybe you should evaluate that and decide, like, because again, I've never felt judged from you talking about your veganism. I try to cut down on things that are harmful for the environment as much as I can, specifically red meat. Like, I cut down on red meat a lot. But it's, like, I have never had to, like, come to grips with, like, a shameful feeling or anything like that. And I think if people really get to that point in the conversation, maybe they should evaluate that themselves.
That's interesting. I think for me, being vegetarian, it's almost the opposite. I find that I like to, like, hold on to it as long as I can before people know that about me so that they can't put stigma on me before getting to know
me. Interesting. Okay.
I don't know if that's something you've experienced.
I don't broadcast it. No, I don't. I don't announce it. But if it comes up, I will share my perspective. But I also think the reason that I think it's important to respect people's decisions and have them get there in their own time is that shame is a terrible motivator.
Yeah.
If you tell someone you're bad for doing this, guilt and shame and fear, that doesn't keep people vegan. That doesn't make people want to do something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not effective. And
well, and it's not sustainable. Because it might work for, you know, a month or whatever, but then it's like they're going to go right back to it and probably double down on it.
Right.
And
then, you know. It needs to come from a place of, this matters to me.
Yeah.
That, and it needs to be values aligned. And also, I think one of the reasons that it's important for me to respect other people's choices when it comes to their own values is that other people have autonomy to make choices. And one of the things about my belief in veganism is that all living things should have autonomy to make decisions that make sense for them,
right,
to like live their lives. Mm-hmm. And I believe animals should have autonomy, and all the people around me should have the autonomy to do what is right for them. And we should give everyone the space to take care of themselves as they see fit.
That's such a fascinating conversation, though, because I have always thought of it as somebody who does still eat meat. Like, I'm so fascinated talking to the two of you because I've always felt that, like, stigma on me, whereas, like, you saying, like, it's kind of the opposite for me. Like, I feel the stigma on the fact that, like, I'm vegetarian or I'm vegan or whatever. I find that so interesting because I think it's interesting that, like, no matter what area you're in of it, you are kind of feeling that in a way, when at the end of the day it's just you make different choices than another person, and that's okay. Like you said, it's all about the autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As long as everyone's eating and our bellies are full, obviously there's a lot more that goes into it than that.
For sure.
But it's just it is interesting, as you're saying, to think about the stigma from both sides.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you, if people are kind of on that path to make better choices, specifically for the environment, what are some kind of switches that they can make easy enough in their day-to-day?
There are lots of things that are just small things. And something that's important to remember is it's better that tons and tons of people are doing things imperfectly than anyone is doing it perfectly.
Let's all microdose veganism.
Right, like, literally. Absolutely, you can. It's great.
You really can.
Let's all take care of the environment bit by bit. Buy things that aren't packaged in plastic. There are plenty of things that you can get. It might be a little bit more work, and if that's something that's accessible to you, which accessibility is also really important to remember.
Right.
And for those people who have access to things, like, if you have the time and the privilege and the luxury of being able to chop up food and peel things on your own instead of buying something that's pre-packaged or pre-made, I think those with the ability to make that choice should make that choice. So cutting down on your plastic waste is always one that I'll advocate for. The city of Toledo actually has a composting program.
Mm-hmm.
Every week or so, I pack up all of my things that can be composted, and they're also very clear on Toledo's websites about composting,
right,
what can be composted, which is lots and lots of things. Food waste is such a huge issue, and you can cut down on that very easily. I go to the botanical gardens and I just dump my compost in the bins that they have right there for free. They're available. You don't have to do anything but collect it and dump it off.
I will say there are a lot of organizations in Toledo that I think have been doing a really upstanding job of making recycling or composting or other mm-hmm. environmentally conscious choices accessible definitely. For people when they might not be in other areas. So I think that is definitely something that people listening should look up, just saying.
Right, yeah. You just have to Google it.
Yeah, City do your research.
Toledo compost program, and there it is.
Well, and I want to talk about – I kind of want to shift gears a little bit here because mm-hmm. there is something that I know you're very passionate about, which is that growing awareness of the intelligence and the social structures of plants, mm-hmm. you know, like trees communicating and mother trees supporting others. And I want to know how you feel that this type of perspective on nature in general mm-hmm. can kind of shift societal views maybe, or the stigma that it's less important than human beings.
Wow. This is a really big question.
It is a big question.
On the mother trees note, I would recommend the book Finding the Mother Tree by Suzanne Simard. She has a beautiful project and learning about the networks of trees and how mother trees advocate for their communities, for their children. Also, shout out to my friend Noah Freilich. He recommended this book to me. And I think language is one of the things that humans use as a way of saying, wow, look at us. We have these languages. We talk to each other in a way that I think that we can recognize the value of nature and of the species and the creatures around us is to quiet down and take a look and see the level of communication and connection.
Yeah.
Across the board, just because they're not speaking a language that we're used to, just because they're not vocalizing the way that we would anticipate or that we can understand at immediate, on a first impression, doesn't mean that the connection between the creatures around us isn't as valuable and meaningful as the connections that we make between ourselves and other humans. Mm. The wisdom and the authenticity and the honesty in the communication between other creatures, it's almost miraculous to me when you can just look around and know that the trees around you are speaking to each other. When yeah. you realize that fish sing to each other, that whales, they have names, they have tone indicators in their languages.
Did y'all not watch Finding Nemo? I'm sorry.
Right, like prairie dogs have, if I'm recalling this fact correctly, one of those intricate languages that we can understand. It's everywhere you look, there is honesty and wisdom, and there are lessons we can learn. And my grandma would always say, this is an acting tip actually, but she would say, just be. And yeah. that is just taking the time to slow down and connect with those around us that maybe aren't human is, again, I feel like I've lost the question because my heart is swelling with thinking about all of the beauty around us that we don't necessarily take the time to slow down.
Hey, that was the point of the question, integrate. So you aced it.
Right. It's everywhere. There's just a lot for us to learn, I think.
Yeah, and obviously you're very passionate about it, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think that you probably need that passion because I can see how this is a very, you know, kind of emotionally taxing labor for you. Yeah. So do you think that's what keeps you going?
Yeah, there is a lot of stress, anxiety when you're in a field where knowing the suffering all around us, the suffering that is human inflicted that we don't have to inflict.
Yeah.
But thinking about the possibilities of things being better, thinking about how much it matters to those individuals who are being impacted by a system that doesn't take their existence. I want to call it their personhood, but that's not the language that we can use for it at this point. But I think of animals, they're not something, they're someone.
Right.
And every animal that is, a lot of the work at the organization I work for is related to cage-free actions. So both on the legislative policy side mm-hmm. and on the corporate side of making sure that animals are free from cages, mostly chickens, but also animals like pigs. And knowing that all the work that I do is to help someone be liberated and have the freedom to move around and exhibit their natural behaviors keeps me coming back every day because it's the right thing to do and it matters to them.
Yeah. I think that's really awesome.
It's really powerful.
And, you know, we started kind of talking about your organization right now, but do you have any long-term goals in regard to your career and then just, you know, based on your interests in the planet and animals in general?
I think I'm going to stay. I'm in the nonprofit space now, and I think that's probably where I'm meant to be. Long-term, it's going to be a matter of staying in line with my values, but I can also see myself moving out of the legal space into becoming a biologist. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just a lifelong dream of mine, maybe getting a PhD in biology.
Yeah.
Learning more about animal language, which is one of my big passions, but
no, for sure. But I think it's really inspiring. I mean, a lot of the guests we have on here are really a testament to how our generation is absolutely just following our passions, but most of us are really passionate about things that help others, which I find so inspiring. And like the fact that you are not only following the thing that you're passionate about, but it's also helping so many people and mm-hmm. so many animals and so many pieces of our planet. It's so inspiring for sure.
Thank you.
What is kind of your perspective then on how your work with activism and the law and public consciousness, how does that all work together at the end of the day to, you know, have an ecosystem where everyone's thriving?
As a just a person trying to do her best, I don't know that I have the answer to that. But I think we can look at things like the movement to heal Lake Erie. There's a movement here in Toledo.
Mm-hmm.
You can walk down by Lake Erie, and anyone who is part of this community knows that. You can smell that Lake Erie isn't thriving. We know we've had to boil water here because of a lot of this is related to issues with agriculture and that runoff going into our water and polluting that ecosystem, which is impacting people and their daily lives, which feeds into lots of other things. You can see the death with the fish rising up in mm-hmm. Lake Erie. And there is a movement now to give Lake Erie legal rights.
Yeah.
So I think that's a place where if communities look around and they can see the impacts that things like animal agriculture have on their community, and that also, if you think about the fact that animal agriculture operations disproportionately affect marginalized communities.
Mm-hmm.
We can take a look at the communities around us, raise public awareness and consciousness, and say the reason that we're feeling these impacts is because of these corporations and these practices that are hurting all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring in the right people with the right knowledge and tie everything together with you have to have interest to make change. It's just a matter of all of us coming together and taking the time to know what matters and
do our part.
Yes, do your part.
I love that.
Absolutely. And we do like to wrap it up with just asking what advice you would give to, you know, either other young professionals like yourself or to anyone who might also be passionate about the environment and its many wonders.
I would say my advice is going to be slow down. And like my grandma would say, just be for a second.
Yeah.
Just be with what is inside of yourself. Think about what you want to see in the world. Where do you want to go? What do you hope to see? And what do you see that could be made better? And how can you be part of that? Whether that's by dumping compost once a week at the botanical gardens.
Right.
Or taking the time to touch a tree. Go outside, breathe the air.
Touch grass.
Literally touch grass. Like,
right.
I don't know.
Kiss your dog.
Oh, kiss your dog.
Right.
Yeah.
I love that. That's
I love
great.
It.
Take a breath.
And And we're back with everybody's favorite segment, our Roman Empires. So I'm actually going to do what I never do, which is let the guest kick it off, because I'm very interested. You said yours is a little more serious. Wow. So I'm interested to see what yours is today.
I think my Roman Empire is going to be, this feels very dorky to say, but it's going to be on the animal biology track. And it is the fact that scientists, I was recently at the Museum of Natural History in New York City, and that at that time, whenever they made the primate exhibit, they weren't sure whether bonobos and chimpanzees were to be considered separate species. This was infuriating. Riley was there. I talked about this.
I was there.
For...
I'm sorry you guys can't see me, but I'm laughing because I was there. I've heard this rant.
Yes, I talked about it for many hours. But they're unsure because these two, they look almost identical. But at some point, the way that evolution works, one of the ways is by separation, by some sort of geographic barrier. At some point in history, bonobos and chimpanzees got separated by a river. And on one side of this river, this is a theory, there were a lot of, not my theory, of course, a lot of resources. And on the other side, there were very few resources. The bonobos happened to be on the very heavily resourced side. Mm-hmm. The chimpanzees, unfortunately, got the sad side with fewer resources. But somehow, because of this setup, bonobos became a species that is matriarchal. So the females run their society. They're a fairly peaceful society. Things are set up very differently than they are on the chimpanzee side. Chimpanzees are run, they have a patriarchy. They're more violent. They're more aggressive. And this is just something I think about. If we had a world where more individuals had the resources that they needed and things were more peaceful,
right?
Imagine. And we have a perfect way to look at it in biology. We have a little setup of these two specific communities.
Right.
And the way that their resource allocation impacted the way that they can interact with each other more peacefully. I could talk about this for a really long period of time. But
hey, you had me at the women run the society.
It's a big one, yes. It's magical. Yeah.
I love it. I love it. And I do also superficially love the name bonobo because I think that's iconic.
I love the bonobos.
Okay, Libby, if it's all right with you, I'm going to kick it off next.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so.
I don't know how you follow that, but.
I really can't. Mine's going to be completely changing topics, which is in the spring of 2025, I get to choreograph the show Godspell nice. With Epiphany Players, and I'm very excited about it. But I'm not talking about that.
Oh.
What I want to talk about is that a theater in Flint, Michigan, did a version of Godspell. But it was in a pool. It was literally in a pool.
Oh,
and
no.
Everyone was calling it God's pool. But, okay, but you say, oh, no. But let me tell you, I didn't see it. I only saw videos of what other people posted and some pictures. But it is the most, dare I say, the most unique imagining of a classic show I've ever seen. I've literally never seen something more creative. And I have to tell you, I mean, Godspell to some people is a very religious show. To some people, it's not. It's just about the tales, you know, that we are given regarding Jesus and Judas. But it's very uniting in the way that it is an inspirational message of loving your fellow man and, you know, all of these really great things that were taught in childhood. But I just cannot get over the creative liberties that they took with this show. I mean, they're all basically wearing bathing suits. There's floaties in the pool. There's like, I mean, it sounds
so absurd.
Was there
like synchronized swimming action?
Kind of, okay. Yes. Like, but it's a shallow pool. Like, it's not very deep. But it just, the artistry with it, the lighting, the production value, the talent. Let me tell you, I don't know that I've ever seen someone more attractive than their Jesus. Like, he was very beautiful. And shout out, because he's also very talented. And I will say the thing that was really neat is obviously with Jesus's crucifixion in the end of that show, I think a lot of people imagine it differently depending on how deep they want to get with it, but they had him kind of up on a high wire and like it was like almost an acrobatic act on a high wire above the pool with all of the rest of the ensemble. I mean, it was just so creative. And and it constantly reminds me that you can never get bored of theater, because even these shows that have been around for years and years and years, you have these creative minds who are ready to push boundaries and reimagine things and come out swinging with a new concept for something. And I'm so fascinated by it. And it makes me excited to do Godspell in the spring. So that's my Roman Empire is God's pool.
Wow. I went straight to the smell of chlorine and the humidity. But now that I wasn't... hear about it, it sounds really cool.
Exactly. And it wasn't deep enough for you to feel like you were in like a pool space.
All right.
You know. All right, Libby, finish us off.
I want to talk about how fish, like pet fish, are so improperly cared for. They're just set up for failure.
Mic drop. Dare you say more? Because,
we can talk about fish in a plastic bag at a carnival.
Because what is that?
And why would you win it as a prize? And then you just have it for the fair the rest of the day and you're Lottie dying and that poor fish is just there. Like, you pretty much know it's going to die the next day.
That's how I ended up with four fish, actually, because I felt so bad that they were just in the plastic bags that I kept getting them. I'm like, let me save them.
And, like, beta fish are just left in those little jars at the store. They need heat and humidity. They're from tropical climates. They can't just be in a bowl with nothing. They need plants and things to hide in their own environments, and all other kinds of fish. It's just very sad. They're not...
The aggressive nodding from all parties in the room right now is crazy.
And I really do think about it a lot because it's just so sad. And I think about when I did not have that information and I was just a child and I had so many fish and I loved them so much, but I did not know how to care for them. And I think we're all very uneducated.
I guess to me, like, pet owning is a responsibility the same as, maybe not the exact same, but similar to like parenthood. Mm-hmm. Like, you obviously are not wanting to have a child until you're ready. You shouldn't really have a pet until you're ready either.
But I feel like with pets, people do their research like reptiles and dogs and cats.
Well, it's like you with your bunnies. You've done extensive research.
You have to do the research. But for some reason, fish, people are just like, don't care. And I feel like that's not fair.
Justice for fish.
Justice for fish. I will scream it from the rooftops.
Literally. And on that note, Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I feel like I learned so much.
I know. You need to do like a weekly environmental segment on our show.
Emily's Corner.
Thanks, Emmy.
Thanks.
We want to thank Emily Hoffman, our guest on today's show. We're your hosts and producers, Libby and Riley, and our executive producer is the wonderful Chris Piper.
If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to listen again, go to wgte.org/comeup or wherever you stream your podcast.
Bye, besties!
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.